This is the Political History of Apollo, a limited series podcast from the Planetary Society exploring the reasons why the United States decided to send humans to the moon and why the nation pulled back after landing only 6 times. I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's chief advocate and senior space policy advisor. I'm going to be joined by some of the world's leading experts in space policy and history in interviews originally broadcast as part of our monthly show, Planetary Radio Space Policy Edition. We grouped these interviews together in an attempt to tell a fuller story about Project Apollo, to get beyond the flags and footprints we so often see, and look at the deeper issues, like the political prehistory of the space age, the Cold War, the political opposition and cultural impacts to the nation, and even look at the Soviet side of the space race to the moon. The show is a production of the Planetary Society, a nonprofit dedicated to space science and exploration. So if you like what you hear, please consider joining or donating at planetary.org/membership. This is Episode 3, The Homefront. Not long after John F. Kennedy announced Project Apollo, the money began to flow. In the fiscal year following its announcement, the White House requested and Congress provided a NASA budget nearly double that of the previous year. The following year, in 1963, NASA's budget doubled again. But heading into 1964 and facing yet another proposed increase, Congress began to push back. It funded NASA, of course, but provided 10% less than that requested by the Kennedy administration. Now, this doesn't sound like much, but it represented the most significant disagreement up to that point between the two branches of government on the priority of the space program. Congressional hearings that year featured skeptics of Apollo and of its cost. Scientists submitted testimony and expressed their worry that Apollo would consume funding better spent on basic research and development. The public even began to question the value of the moon program, with upwards of 40% not approving of the effort in 1964, and ongoing majorities of the public believing that the effort was, quote, not worth the cost throughout the decade. Even President Kennedy began to reconsider his national commitment to Apollo, and its stated goal of beating the Soviet Union to the moon. Listen to this part of a speech to the United Nations he gave on September 20th, 1963, and remember that he gave this just 1 year after he spoke at Rice University, stating that the moon race was something that the United States intended to win.
There is room for new cooperation, for further joint efforts in the regulation and exploration of space. I include among these possibilities a joint expedition to the moon. Why, therefore, should man's first flight to the moon be a matter of national competition? Why should the United States and the Soviet Union, in preparing for such expeditions, become involved in immense duplications of research, construction, and expenditure? Surely we should explore whether the scientists and astronauts of our two countries, indeed of all the world, cannot work together in the conquest of space.
Kennedy was assassinated just a few months after that speech, so we'll never know what could have happened had he remained in office. But it's possible that history would have unfolded very differently. I raise these points about opposition and second-guessing because it's so easy to ignore them when looking back onto something as momentous and exciting as landing on the moon for the first time. But I think it's important to remember that Apollo was not uniformly supported by the public, and it really did not depend on public support to succeed. And that's not really how we tend to look at it now. However, as we know, and at the same time, there was an explosion of space-related cultural engagement in the United States, both through mass media and in person through things like tourism. People really enjoyed the promise and optimism represented by space exploration. And despite the occasional pushback from Congress, NASA did get the money it needed to succeed in sending humans to the moon. Annual funding legislation, at the time, would pass with significant congressional majorities. So to try to reconcile the opposition and support for the space program during this period, I spoke with Dr. Emily Margolis, whose dissertation, Space Travel at 1G, Space Tourism in Cold War America, explores these very issues. Dr. Margolis, thank you for joining us today on the Space Policy Edition and the special series of Apollo podcasts that we're doing here at the Planetary Society. Previously, our listeners learned about why Apollo happened, the political and international context that created this weird nexus of funding availability for a massive space undertaking. And what I really want to explore today is the domestic side of that and the cultural impact. How did Apollo move forward? What was the impact to the public? And was it a smooth ride for that program? So just really to set the context for all of us, including you and I, who were not alive in the 1960s, we're coming out of the 1950s. You had Eisenhower, who himself was kind of coming out of this post-World War II era. The economy is starting to grow. You have this new thing called the Interstate Highway System, this huge, massive public works project. You have a new type of maybe leisure class happening in the United States. What are some of the major themes and what are some of the major changes happening culturally and politically in the United States in the early 1960s when JFK announced Project Apollo?
Thanks so much for having me, Casey. In the post-war period, the United States was enjoying a time of economic prosperity that it hadn't known in a long while, and this had a material impact on the way Americans lived their lives. After having ration coupons and growing victory gardens, people had money in their pocket and they wanted to buy things that they had been denied during the war. And one of the most coveted items that people were interested in the early days of the Cold War was the private automobile ownership. People really wanted their own cars. Automobile factories had been converted to wartime production. And when they reconverted back to producing cars, people wanted to get in them and they wanted to enjoy their America's roadside. Starting in 1956 with the Interstate Highway Act, there was a proposal for over 40,000 new roadways to be built in the United States. So all of a sudden, people had spending money, they had a means of transportation, they had more places to go, and they also had an interest in exploring our nation. So there was a renaissance at mid-century of this phenomenon called heritage travel, which first really emerged in the late 19th century in the United States after the Civil War, when there was a concerted national effort to bring Americans to national parks and historic sites as a way of reaffirming a unified national identity after the Civil War. In the Cold War period, this newly mobile middle class was interested in visiting the very same sites, but as a way of recommitting to American values, which were contrasted with the Soviet Union in this battle of ideologies. And so people wanted to go to the cradle of democracy. They flocked to Independence Hall. They visited the Liberty Bell. They visited the monuments in Washington, D.C. and the Gettysburg Battlefield as a way of proclaiming their citizenship in the Cold War.
I think that's really fascinating. Do you think it was a concerted effort, like a top-down effort to make this happen? And was there a kind of government or captains of industry, for lack of a better term, trying to make this happen? Or was this just a ground-up attitude, natural response to this kind of oppressive regime contrasted against who they are?
Mm-hmm. It's mixed, right? So there are people who are wanting to experience these sites, and you have communities where these sites are located who are working incredibly hard to make them seem appealing and working on national publicity campaigns. So you've got PR and marketing coming oftentimes from chambers of commerce. And then later on in the Johnson administration, there was national tourism promotion campaigns, and they provided resources to help Americans plan their journey throughout the United States.
Do you think this is really the first time that Americans had leisure as a priority in their lives? I mean, it seems like, particularly after, in contrast to World War II, as you point out, with kind of deprivation, sacrifice for this massive mobilization, right? And mobilize the entire country functionally, that now it was almost like, enjoy the fruits of that sacrifice, right? Like, not only are you going to consume, right? You had this whole consumer culture really created around then, but you're going to take your kids in that giant Buick and drive around. And the whole thing just seems so quintessentially American, but also really modern, really, when you think about it, right?
Mm-hmm. I'd say so. I think that when the road trip sort of emerged in the 1950s and 60s, what made it so different from any kind of form of travel that Americans had enjoyed before is that it was widely accessible. So beginning, I think in 1960, 75 million Americans took to the road as in pursuit of pleasure, which is higher than any number of leisure travelers at any earlier time in history, right? So you're definitely tapping into the newness of this phenomenon that has to do with the convergence of a new highway system, new access to automobiles, a more affluent middle class, and also an interest in this heritage travel in the Cold War. I should also mention that beginning in the 1940s, employers began to recognize a correlation between worker productivity and time off. And so employers were starting to give more vacation time. And so all of these coalesced to create mass tourism on a scale that had never been experienced in the United States.
Would you say that was really the early 1960s? Was that really the birth of kind of our modern conception of middle class and capitalism, that kind of infusion of the two where you would have mass access, you had mass, you said mobility, which is nice. We're not just class mobility in a sense, but physical mobility, being able to choose where to go. That almost seemed to fundamentally change the relationship of broad public to not only, you know, their self-conception as a nation, but also to the government that represents them, because anyone had access to go and look at something if they wanted to, right?
Absolutely. So in the 1960s, tourism emerged on a mass scale as never before seen. Over 75 million Americans took to the roads in pursuit of pleasure in 1960. But the way that they pursued these experiences depended on race. So there were communities in which African-Americans were unwelcome. And for them, traveling could be inconvenient to downright dangerous. So they were denied services at a lot of places, motels, hotels, gas stations, restaurants, etc. And so Victor Green published a book called, which we know as the Green Book, which provided a travel guide for African-American travelers at this time. We have to remember that the birth of the road trip, the golden age of the road trip, also happened during the civil rights era.
I think that's a really important point. That's something I want to touch on, particularly in a little bit as mm-hmm. we get more into the NASA aspect of this. But you're right. I mean, when I conceive of this experience, or when I conjure up this image, it's a white family going on a road trip, right, in a big car. And that's not a representative view of the country at the time. And that's a really important, I think, and will be an echoing important part of this, because it's also, as you point out, in the early 1960s, the civil rights movement is kind of at the beginning aspect of it, right? This starts to become a bigger and bigger issue as we go through the 1960s, which will impact domestic politics. Let's say politically at this point, let's jump up to a bigger picture. So we have this growth of a consumer culture, we have a growth of a tourism culture, leisure culture, growing middle class. There's obviously, we should mention, the baby boom happening here, right? So everyone has kids, it feels like.
Right.
Politically, this seems like a relatively stable time. We have very large, kind of somewhat enduring Democratic majorities in Congress. You have a Democratic president right now in JFK who's coming in reaction to seen as kind of a lackadaisical attitude towards Cold War confrontation of Eisenhower. He announces Project Apollo. What's the initial kind of political reaction to Apollo? I remember reading that JFK himself was a little unsure after he made his big announcement mm-hmm. to Congress that he maybe went too far, that no one would actually pay for this. So was there an easy, quick response from Congress, or was there real battles initially to get this project funded?
I'm glad that you mentioned JFK's hesitation, because he's the president most often associated with both Project Apollo and the space program in general. And his legacy is felt even today. If you listen to politicians, they echo his rhetoric all the time. And if you listen to his two most famous speeches about the space program, the May 25th, 1961 speech on the urgent national needs before Congress, where he announced Project Apollo, he's very clear that he has taken into consideration the fact that he's asking the nation's taxpayers to fund this effort, and he doesn't make this request lightly. And so I think his thoughtfulness helped to garner support at the time. That was very measured. And then his second speech, which was September 12th, 1962 at Rice University, is much more a rallying cry. We've already committed to this, so we're going to see it through. You can trace a difference in his rhetoric to perhaps the fact that by 1962, people were already starting to question the price tag. And so he really needed to get people on board. We had already set on this track, and now we're really rallying the troops. And it's so interesting. The speech is given in the stadium at Rice University, and it almost feels like a kind of pep rally.
Yeah, this is we don't go because it's easy, but because it is hard, right?
Exactly. Like
he's the rah-rah aspect. And it's interesting because people, I think, really do infuse those two speeches together in their heads in mm-hmm. retrospect, but they are really distinct in terms of what he's pitching. And I guess his audience is obviously quite different at the time. But Congress, there may have been some consternation, but fundamentally, you look at the numbers, right? Like NASA's budget functionally doubled mm-hmm. in the first year, then it doubled again mm-hmm. in the next year, right? And so the money began to flow. Something that you brought up, and I don't know if there's a clear answer to this or not, but do you think part of the reason why Kennedy was able to pull something like this off was because the United States had just gone through a massive public infrastructure project with the interstate highway system, and it worked, and people benefited from it, and they had a high trust in government to pull something off? Do you think that played into people's acceptance of this challenge?
I think that the highway system was still in progress, right? So it wasn't finished for many years, although it was coming along, so that was a sign that government worked. But what historians say about Project Apollo is that it really demonstrated to the American public on a level that hadn't been seen prior that the government works. It can set goals and achieve them by a specific date. Whether or not people agreed with whether that was the correct goal for the country at the time is a side point, but most people said this is, and so that's why you often hear, if we can go to the moon, why can't we do X, Y, or Z? Because that's our way of saying government works, right? But there was a lot of a disagreement at the time, even starting in 62, 63, about whether Project Apollo was a good idea, because it was going to happen at such an accelerated rate that it would require a lot of resources. And I don't just mean money, but I also mean brain power. We needed the nation's best scientists, engineers, and managers. And so the American public was very concerned about what would happen when all of these resources were applied to getting to the moon. Well, we have lots of problems going on the ground. So even though Project Apollo's budget doubled, essentially between 61 and 62, and then basically all of the Congress people, especially Olin Teague, who was the chair of the House Subcommittee on Manned Spaceflight, he was getting tons of letters from his constituents, and people were making it clear that we think the money is better spent elsewhere. And they gave him pages and pages of handwritten and typed notes, education, poverty, curing cancer, right? We should be putting our money towards these really important efforts to fix what's going on the ground before we start to explore the barren expanse of the moon.
I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think there is a tendency, particularly obviously among space advocates and fans, but I think just really among the public at large, to kind of forget that there was kind of a divisive choice to do this. There were people in opposition to going to the moon, right? I'd say like the very basic standard story that we hear a lot is this very romanticized ideal where Kennedy goes up, this youthful president challenges the nation, and by God, we all roll our shirt sleeves up and we do it. And then it's done, and everyone kind of pats themselves on the back. But it wasn't straightforward, and people were upset that we were spending all that money on something as really esoteric as going to the moon, particularly in the 1960s. I mean, right when Kennedy made his first speech to Congress, that was right after Alan Shepard, basically. I mean, the U.S. had just sent an up and down astronaut. Now we're talking about landing on the moon. You bring up someone, Olin Teague, which I confess, I didn't know really that story until I read your dissertation about this. Did he write a report? He was looking at a report. Something triggered him to be concerned about Project Apollo. He himself was a supporter, correct?
Yes and no. So he was the chair of this committee that was responsible for holding NASA accountable to the American public and making sure that they were on track to achieve their goals. And from that basis, we would determine how much money they would get in the next appropriation cycle. So he himself was a supporter of the space program, but also had reservations about how the money was being used. He was concerned about the finances. So when he was serving in this position, he was getting letters from constituents, as I mentioned. He also received a survey that was conducted by the Grumman Aircraft Corporation at the time. Grumman was one of the prime contractors for Project Apollo.
They made the lunar lander, right?
Yes. And they were very much interested in public opinion because their contracts depended on whether or not Project Apollo would continue. And so they went out and they did interviews with people on the street and also with public intellectuals to see what people thought and felt about Project Apollo. And those results came across Teague's desk and they echoed what he was receiving in his letters from the people that he represented and realized that NASA was really in a moment of crisis because the funding was dependent on public support. And there was a lot of criticism about the way these dollars were being spent.
Something I was thinking in reaction to that was, you look at Apollo, at the time they spent about $25 billion, which in today, depending on how you adjust for inflation, works out to about $250 billion or so, right? There's a couple different ways to do it. A decent chunk of change, right? But compared to what they were spending on Vietnam or all these major programs, it wasn't the dominant thing. But space is really visible, right? I mean, they're rockets. They're big and imposing, lots of hardware. You had the whole kind of cultural kind of representation of space that I want to get to in a second. Do you think that this permanent conception of the public, that the space is always fantastically expensive, do you think that formed with Apollo because of that rapidness of the change as opposed to just ramping up slowly to it?
Absolutely, right. The expenditures were growing and growing, doubling, you know, between fiscal years. And that certainly gave the perception that space was fantastically expensive, but it also gave the impression that space is irrelevant sort of to people's daily lives. So Vietnam impacted people in their daily life. They may have had a son, a brother, family member who was serving, right? Or they would be seeing on the news what was happening. They may have themselves been living in subpar conditions. There was a housing crisis going on. They could have been experiencing poor education, right? So going to the moon is an exciting thing, but it doesn't impact your daily life. So if you were to turn off the TV or not read a newspaper, you wouldn't have a sense that it was going on.
Right.
And so if we're putting money towards something that doesn't have a material impact on your daily life, it's an easy target.
Yeah.
And so something that NASA tried to do is prove its terrestrial value to the American taxpayers.
And so there was this problem in a sense, right, that you have, you're ramping up the spending. I think it's that combination of spending increasing really rapidly, more than maybe even just the total amount, the increase of it, the news of it, the visual aspect of it being almost like an excess, like it's almost like toys or in a sense, you can argue that Apollo was kind of like a peacock kind of plumage showing off for the country, which is supposed to be imposing and impressive and expensive looking. Right. I think it's fascinating, again, to look at the responses that you collected that Teague had. Well, I have it written down right here. It's called Attitude Toward the Moon Race Among Opinion Leaders and the General Public. Right. It just rolls off the tongue. I can't believe we didn't remember it.
Right.
I just want to hear a few more examples of public and political opposition to the Apollo program, particularly in the early 1960s, as funding was coming anyway. You mentioned that people were writing and complaining about the money. We have public polling saying that they think money would be better spent on education. There's at least one other aspect of opposition to NASA that I found really fascinating. Can you talk about some of those?
There was actually opposition to Project Apollo from the scientific community. Many scientists felt that the money necessary to build human-grade spacecraft was wasted because there could be autonomous spacecraft and landers and satellites that could do the same scientific work. And much more work could be done if given the budget of Project Apollo. So that there was a serious angle of criticism that came from scientists. And there's always been a tension between the scientific community and NASA regarding human spaceflight that sort of persisted even until the shuttle era.
Yeah, exactly. There's a scientific resistance to it, and not just in space science, but larger scientific broadly, right, in the United States, right? You highlighted some serious concerns that people said, like, why not focus this on X problem as opposed to going to the moon.
Right. Curing cancer or improving education, building new schools, endowing fellowships for graduate study in fields that were deemed relevant to the national agenda. But I think what all of this gets to is the fundamental misconception that NASA has been fighting from the beginning, which is that a space dollar could easily be reappropriated to some other cause. And that's just not how the government works. And so because NASA is so visible, it is an easy target. And because it is so abstract, people feel like it's not as deserving, perhaps, as more tangible efforts on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's the first fallacy of all arguments against the space program is that you could just plop, you know, you can just excise the NASA budget and move it into something else, right? The money would just never be there
exactly.
to begin with, right? There was one more piece of resistance that I thought was fascinating, which was on religious grounds.
Sure.
To the Apollo program.
Right. So religious critique of the space program was the smallest subset of critique, period. People would write in and say that, you know, the heavens are God's realm and we shouldn't mess with it. That's not for us to explore. If we were meant to explore it, we would be there already. There were all sorts of critiques of Project Apollo. And I think in some ways, the critiques show a deep engagement by the American public. They were really grappling with what is the significance of spaceflight? How is it relevant to me on a financial level, on a religious level, right? The critiques, they're a really rich source for historians to think about.
But this was 62, 63
right.
that this was happening,
63,
right?
Late 63.
So at the early part of this effort, right? And this is in the heat of the space race where the Soviets were still putting up stuff, the first Soviet spacewalk, you know, they were launching humans into space all the time, the first woman in space. It didn't matter. And so this conception of the space race driving this whole public opinion and the whole public was behind this really isn't the accurate story here, right?
Right. And that's the reason that NASA had such an expansive public affairs operation at the time. So when NASA was founded in 1958 with the National Aeronautics and Space Act, it was charged with three responsibilities by Congress: to conduct aeronautical and space research, to involve the scientific community in that research, and to provide for the widest practicable and appropriate dissemination of information relating to those activities. So public affairs was essentially one of the three fundamental pillars of NASA's formation, because it was understood that the public was going to need to know how these dollars were being spent, how it was relevant to them, and why.
The very forward-looking congressional staffer, whomever, who wrote that line in the NASA Authorization Act. And again, maybe anticipating this, right? So this brings up an issue I think we should touch on, which is the cultural kind of representation of space, particularly up to this point in the early 60s, before things are really starting to get rolling, where it was really fantasy and fiction, right? I've read Howard McCurdy's book on space and the American imagination and this idea that Apollo was able to happen because, in a sense, the public had been primed to understand space travel, and it wasn't just a laughable proposition. But at the same time, the way that it was represented in media was kind of laughable, right? Like, what was space presented to the public like at this point?
So in the 20s through the 50s, that's when spaceflight really entered into American popular culture through figures like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. And people were following these serialized accounts of their adventures in space in comics and radio and television. These were essentially dramas that happened to occur in space. And there was some attention to potentially like scientific aspects of spaceflight, but that really wasn't at the heart of it. As you watch popular culture evolve after the start of NASA, you see that the public is starting to demand greater accuracy in their pop culture experiences related to spaceflight. And so you start to see the development of television shows like Man in the Challenge and Man in Space, where it's focusing on characters that could easily be a real person. Without ray guns, they were Air Force colonels who were interested in traveling into space, right? And then you eventually get back into the fantasy starting into the sort of the late 60s with things like I Dream of Jeannie. But the fantastical element is not the space flight. It's the genie companion.
<That's, yeah>.
Exactly.
We should touch on, of course, which most of our listeners already are familiar with, the Collier's articles, of course, in the 50s.
Absolutely.
And then the Disney TV shows that maybe even more important to the general public. Why don't we just briefly discuss those? Because those were presented scientifically, but they were very much propaganda in a sense.
Absolutely. The group of individuals responsible for the Collier series are known as the Space Boosters. They were really trying to boost public regard for spaceflight, showing them that it wasn't just fantasy, but it was actually feasible. And look at the work that's been done to get us to this point. It was a herald saying that spaceflight is imminent. It's no longer in the realm of fantasy. The Collier series was started in 52, and then in 54 through 57, I believe, Von Braun took the message of the Collier's magazines, which had reached about 12 million people, to Walt Disney's Disneyland television series, and 42 million people, almost a quarter of the American public, watched these episodes. And what's interesting both about Collier's and about the Disney productions is that they're not completely divorced from fantasy, because the Collier's magazines were illustrated by Chesley Bonestell, who himself had worked in Hollywood beforehand, and he was imagining all of these landscapes and spacecraft in space that no one could see. And so there was an element of fantasy in selling the written word that accompanied that in Collier's. And then, of course, when you have Disney involved in the series in which Von Braun consulted and also appeared on screen, you have the Disney Imagineers who are doing the graphics. You have really fun and totally approachable cartoons that talk about the physics of rocket propulsion, right? Those two elements were very much representative of this transition and how the public consumed spaceflight and what they expected of that.
Yeah, and that was happening in the late 50s, kind of leading right up to Absolutely. When the actual space age began. Mm-hmm. And there's just something so interesting looking back at this. I mean, something you just said really stuck with me, that like a quarter of the American populace saw that Disney show because there was, what, three channels, right?
Right.
And if you just, you had one in three chance of watching it, basically. And then I guess the other quarter just didn't watch TV that night. It reminds you at this point that there was really much a stronger monoculture in a sense, and or at least in terms of gatekeeping of what was represented in culture, right? And we'll get to some of this again more in terms of who was represented and who was welcome and who wasn't. But the idea, and it makes me think about this idea for Apollo. We've touched on this, but I think we can just answer this right now. Was Project Apollo the result of a grassroots demand?
No, not at all.
Right.
It could not be more top-down. It came from the president's desk.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah. And you really don't see that as much these days, right? Because of our whole media ecosystem is so much more diverse, right? And then, of course, I mean, there's a lot of other factors, but what we're seeing, I think, with Apollo is in a sense, and also in terms of how we look back and see Apollo through the eyes of Walter Cronkite, or, you know, these kind of great men of broadcasting at the time, because there was three networks, in a sense, a triumph or relied on this idea that if you could capture the people who made the influencing content and media, then you could really do a lot with that. And so, like, Von Braun's insight, I think, was that he was able to access and influence and inspire not just the public, but the gatekeepers to the public.
Absolutely. As an insight into some of Von Braun's strategy, before he collaborated with Disney, he actually had a contract to work with CBS. But he felt when the Disney offer came through that he would reach a wider audience through Disney and it would be a better production quality. And so he was able to get out of the CBS contract as a result of the various production delays.
Yeah. I remember reading that. I was like, that's a very savvy insight.
Absolutely.
At the time, right? And again, the reason I bring this up is because we've already touched on this, but this idea that the people who didn't like how Apollo money was being spent, I mean, they were functionally sidelined for the first 5 years of the program. I mean, NASA's budget grew. I remember the peak appropriation was in 1965. NASA's peak spending was in 1966. And, you know, so we had 4 years, really, of just up, 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 up. It kind of coincided with, obviously, JFK's overlap and then Lyndon Johnson's takeover of the program. Very helpfully, those are the most important years in any space development project, is that the money shows up to start figuring out how to do it, right? That's when you need the money. Let's start moving into going back to Teague, the Representative Teague in the House, was a Committee on Manned Spaceflight?
The Subcommittee.
Subcommittee on Manned Spaceflight. So he's starting to get more and more feedback that in reaction to the incredible growth of spending in Apollo, people are starting to react negatively to it. Maybe you take over the story from here. What does he decide to do in reaction to this?
Well, Teig makes an incredibly radical suggestion. He writes to James Webb, administrator of NASA, in early 1964. So in December of 63, he had gotten the survey from Grumman, you know, had a year's worth of correspondence suggesting that the public is starting to feel really ambivalent about Project Apollo. And he writes to Webb and says, I think that we need to allow the American people to see how their money is being spent in a more participatory fashion. And we should open up the Kennedy Space Center to visitors.
There are two things that I really find fascinating about that. One is that his confidence that just by seeing it, people would be transformed or convinced, right? It kind of touches on Roger Lanius's paper that I love about human spaceflight as a religion, right? Like if the scales just fall out of their eyes, they'll be converts to the cause. But also the idea that there wasn't a way to access this before, and that this didn't come from NASA. This came from someone in Congress. So was NASA just completely out of the game on this? Were they just focusing on the project? They weren't thinking about these larger issues of public support?
They were very much concerned with the larger issues of public support. They had a very active public affairs apparatus. There was a center at headquarters, and every NASA center had their own PAO, public affairs office. And they did everything from exhibits to educational programs to even running an art program. So NASA was on top of it. But when it came to access to its space centers, they were often run like secure military installations. There was dangerous work being performed there, and some of the work that was going on was classified. So there wasn't a reason for the public to come on board. Teig's suggestion was quite radical in that he wanted to open these gates to the public, but his confidence was not. It came from the fact that in his own personal experience, he would often tour the Cape and other NASA facilities, and sometimes he would bring friends or constituents who had asked to come along, and he saw that their reactions changed after they had seen the scope and the scale of what was going on at NASA. People really couldn't comprehend how big this operation was, how many people were involved until they saw it on the ground.
Yeah, literally true, until you see the vehicle assembly building. There's like that difference between experiential and informational knowledge, right? Like I can tell you how big the VAB is, but you don't feel how big it is until you see it, right? And it's, I always think of like, that's one aspect of why that sort of pseudo-religiosity reaction is kind of present in spaceflight, is because you are really standing against something that's immense, and you're presented right in this weird contrast with something that's beyond almost interpretation of how big it is. I think there's also something really fascinating about this, and that this is the essence of why you have public representation in politics, right? That this came from the People's House, you know, the House of Representatives, that it was his idea to start opening up these areas to people. So what did he do exactly to make this happen? I mean, he's a powerful member of Congress. So what did he do to push NASA to do this?
So Teig made the money appear to make these visitor programs happen. And he knew it would be successful, not only because of his experience of dealing with friends and colleagues who toured the Cape, but because the Cape, since the early or late 1950s, had been attracting tourists. Tourists were coming to watch launches, and they weren't able to access the Space Center. At the time, NASA was launching out of the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. And so Teig knew there was already an audience for this. He had seen what could happen to this audience through access to the Space Center, and he conveyed this to James Webb, and Webb was in agreement, and essentially Teig was able to earmark a little over $1 million in the appropriations budget to build a visitor information center, the VIC, which actually still exists today, but has been modified quite a bit. But the VIC was a long time in coming, so there were multiple stages of access. At first, in late 1964, the Kennedy Space Center opened up a trailer that was parked alongside of the Space Center. It was actually outside of the gates. And the reason for this is that the Space Center was still under construction. People were working 7 days a week. It wasn't possible for visitor safety purposes to allow others to come onto the site. After that, in early 1965, the pace of construction slowed to 6 days a week. And on Sundays, visitors were welcome welcome to take a self-guided driving tour of the Kennedy Space Center. They would roll up in the family automobile and they would get a brochure with a map. They were not permitted to stop, but they could take photos. So I like to imagine how many families have blurry photos of the Kennedy Space Center tucked into photo albums somewhere in the attic. So reach out to me if you got them.
Right, because I mean, you didn't see the pictures until you developed them like a week and a half later, right?
Exactly.
Back in the day.
Right. That was throughout 1965. And then the Kennedy Space Center began working with TWA, Trans World Airlines, who provides many services besides transportation between LA and New York. And they started to operate a bus tour. It was a 7 days a week tour that started in 1966 in the summer. And then by the summer of 67, the VIC had finally opened. So it was a 3-4 year process in the making, and it quickly became one of the top tourist attractions in the state. This was before Walt Disney World opened. And after Disney World opened, there's sort of been a nice symbiotic relationship between the Cape and between Disney. The Disney cruises leave out of Port Canaveral. So now people will often see both sites when they go down to visit Florida. So the origins of access to the Space Center, which we totally take for granted today, were really because of Olin Teague's efforts.
Was this, again, more of a top-down or bottom-up? Because I recall in your dissertation talking about that people would start to just show up at NASA centers, right? Just wondering what was going on.
Yeah, completely unannounced. I find that so remarkable that without any formal invitation or indication that there would be anything to see or do, they just wanted to get close to the space program. They wanted to see what was going on, how their money was being spent. That's really difficult to do if you can't get on site. For the folks who traveled down to Florida, you might even have the benefit of watching a launch. You don't need to be on site to see that. You can see it from miles away. So there was this audience that was already there. And what's really interesting is that at the same time that NASA was realizing we have this audience, let's make use of it, the local community is having the same realization. And so they start to develop space-themed tourism industries in Brevard County, in Huntsville, Alabama, in Houston, Texas, where all the major NASA human spaceflight centers are located. And so this is why you have things like the Starlight Motel in Cocoa Beach, the Gemini Room, and things like that.
Yeah, I remember driving down some back road in Brevard County and seeing an old rundown gas station with a space shuttle mock-up on top in the middle of nowhere, right? And it was just all of these things come together. And so this feels like the nexus of all these kind of themes we were kind of bringing together, right? The growth of leisure culture, middle class, mobile class, right? To be able to drive and see these things. And then with this attitude of, well, we're a democracy, we exist on the taxpayers, whether they're happy with us or not. So we owe it to them to open it up, right? And mm-hmm. So you would even say, like, they even opened it up to Soviet citizens who wanted to come by and take a look at it, right?
They did. There was a guest book at the Kennedy Space Center. And anytime a visitor from the USSR came through, there was always an article in the KSC employee newsletter sort of heralding the fact that, you know, we are open and transparent, so different from our adversaries.
This whole idea, I think, there's this weird contrast that I still can't figure out, conundrum that I'm trying to figure out here. And maybe it's impossible because you can't just apply one attitude towards a country of 200 million people at the time. But you're seeing this obvious interest in the space program, right? You're seeing a cultural consumption of it, right? In terms of media, TV shows, fiction, but at the same time, significant ambivalence about whether it's worth it. And I kept going back to this idea of, particularly in this 1960s United States, of what people like versus what they're willing to pay for, right? What they're willing to prioritize. Because, I mean, just to go back to some of the polling data that Roger Lanius and others have put together, Apollo was never that popular. I mean, you have a couple of ways of, like, basically, was Apollo worth it? And I think briefly right after Apollo 11, it cracked 50%.
Right.
But never above that.
Right.
So less than half of the country thought it was ever worth it. So how do you think we can talk about this? Like, was, when you talk about support for Apollo, looking at particularly the growth of tourism and the obvious demand, how do you reconcile these two aspects of the nation with this?
There's certainly a difference between what people will consume and what they will support. And I think that that tension led to NASA becoming ever more creative in its ways to reach the American public. But specifically within the realm of tourism, there's a complicating factor. There's nothing more powerful than seeing the real thing. But the only people willing to go and see the real thing are the ones who are already sympathetic to the effort. Yeah. And so that gets back to why NASA allowed photographs when people toured KSC and why they had made sure that the Visitor Information Center had a gift shop, because they were hoping to turn the visitors into ambassadors for Project Apollo. They would go back into their home communities and show their friends photographs and say, look at this great work that we are supporting, that this is your space program. And so you should know what's going on.
This may be impossible, but is there any way to quantify the consequences of those tourism or opening things up? Did it have any palpable change in public opinion or funding or political support? Any insight into that?
You know what, that is such a hard thing to quantify. And unfortunately, no one has been interested in doing a survey about that that could have been useful to me in my research. But I think what it's done is created a sense of entitlement, perhaps, because we feel today that we should be able to access NASA centers. Because of that, I think that that creates an interest, perhaps, in that this is our program, we can see it, we should weigh in on it. We have a voice. We should voice our opinion about what's going on. So whether or not the opinion that's voiced is one that is helpful or hurtful to NASA is something to be seen. But I think it allows people to feel connected and have agency. They're not just patrons, but they also are participants in this effort in some way.
Do you feel like there was a turning point in the 1960s in terms of political support for Apollo? Is there any particular moment or a series of incidents that happened that changed how the country approached it, or at least from a political level?
I think the moon landing itself really was the end to the space race. We did it. After that, people stopped tuning in to watch coverage of the subsequent Apollo missions. The last three missions were canceled completely. And so I think that was the moment at which things changed, because it ended. You know, we had achieved this feat. And because NASA was so set on this singular goal for almost a decade of getting to the moon and returning astronauts safely home, this meant that they hadn't put any effort or time or money into other endeavors. They were almost a one-trick pony, and they had performed that trick and then it was over.
I'll have an upcoming whole episode to talk about what they decided to do next. But when you achieve something so well, clearly, right? That was the goal. It almost seemed to undermine whatever latent political, I mean, because again, it felt like there's a tension running this whole time, I think, that we've established to some degree, where there may have been some reticence to fund these incredible amounts, but ultimately the funding showed up when it was needed.
Right.
It peaked and was declining by the time the first landing happened. It was still substantial compared to today. The landing itself maybe seemed to resolve that tension. Now that was just, all right, we've done it. Now we don't have to keep reluctantly funding this crazy program. Like we've shown that we can beat the Soviets or something. But maybe also by 69, culture had changed also substantially too, right? You want to just touch on what had changed in the country in the last 9 years?
Sure. So at this point, we are under the presidency of Richard Nixon. He was very much interested in the political effects of Project Apollo, very much in a similar vein to Kennedy. Nixon recognized the international implications of this effort. And so he rode the coattails of Project Apollo in an international tour called Moon Glow. Right after Apollo 11, there was an international tour called Giant Step, where the astronauts traveled across the world. And this created a lot of political goodwill abroad, but the American public still felt like they had all of these issues that hadn't been resolved from the early 60s, right? And now we have the Vietnam War going on. There was just a lack of interest in continuing to support something without these clear ground-based applications, which is why in 1970, NASA starts to publish Spinoff Magazine as a way of saying, look at all of these valuable technologies that we've produced in the quest of reaching the moon that can be useful elsewhere. It's also in the late 1960s where NASA actually starts to work more with other agencies. So in 68, they start to collaborate with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. They're trying to work on these spin-off technologies, because what is the Apollo command module and service module and LEM if not a self-contained housing unit that's sustainable? And so people who had still unresolved housing issues in urban environments said, well, maybe the NASA engineers can help us solve these problems. And so they started to work together. So starting in the late 1960s, NASA became more engaged with these larger problems.
It strikes me too that by the end of the 60s, when the political support disappears, NASA didn't have the public level of support necessary to counter that. And we brought this up at the very beginning, or you brought this up at the very beginning. I want to touch on this too, which is the idea of representation in NASA, both for gender and race. Obviously, all the Apollo astronauts were white men. Most of the people at NASA were white men. You even talked about in terms of the leisure class and vacationing and tourism was predominantly, particularly in the South, you had a lot of issues with race. Briefly here, what do you think the consequences are from NASA, whether it was purposeful or not, the exclusionary practices that they had in terms of both representation as astronauts, but also in access to their sites themselves?
Mm-hmm. I think the best representation of this sense of exclusion is explored by Gil Scott-Heron in his spoken word poem, Whitey on the Moon, right? Which doesn't come out until 72, I believe, but reflects a whole decade's worth of feeling excluded. The African-American community felt like the U.S. government wasn't hearing its concerns and put money towards this effort of putting a white man on the moon, essentially. There was also a sense of exclusion. There are reports in the New York Times right after the moon landing of bars in African-American neighborhoods in New York where they chose to watch a local baseball game instead of the moon landing as protest, not just because they felt like they hadn't been, their concerns hadn't been prioritized by the government, but also that they had been excluded from this effort. There was an attempt in the early 1960s to include an African-American astronaut, a man, of course, Ed Dwight, and he ultimately didn't make the cut for various reasons. There was also protests at NASA centers among by women who said, you know, well, why aren't we here? The Soviet Union had Valentina Tereshkova go up in 1963, and there totally could have been a woman on the moon. So there were communities who were eager to change the makeup of NASA. I should say that NASA did change the communities in which it was located because they were federal institutions. They could not be segregated, and so the local communities in Huntsville, for example, desegregated more quickly than the rest of Alabama. So there was sort of that change going on. But in general, the big change would happen in the shuttle era. More already civil rights legislation that was passed. There was just a public expectation that the shuttle corps would look like the American public.
Yeah, they did most of the hiring of the Apollo era astronauts in the early 1960s, right, before most of the civil rights legislation had passed.
Absolutely. And there was a really important note essentially in the hiring criteria, which was that you had to have experience piloting a jet. And so that essentially disqualified women from taking on these positions, even though there was no, you know, header at the top, you know, women not wanted, this was their way of executing mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, we're in kind of a recent period of our culture where we're looking at some of those voices that weren't represented as much. But I mean, the point of those movies and books is that those were exceptions. I'm thinking of Hidden Figures and others.
Yes.
Where it's inspiring, but the point is that that's an exception to the norm.
Absolutely.
You go back to why did Apollo happen and why hasn't it not happened again and probably will never happen again. I wonder if, curious to hear your thoughts on this, like because NASA enjoyed such overwhelming political support mm-hmm. separated from overwhelming public support, it didn't have to build that up to rely on it initially, right? It could just go and do the moon program. And it could kind of blindly accept the exclusionary practices or whatever, you know, I don't know the details of those, but it didn't bring people in at a large level. And so when it desperately needed political support in the late 60s, women weren't fully engaged. People of color weren't fully engaged. And so you just already handicapped themselves from having access to the full public support you would even need to continue something like this, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely part of the story.
Going back to the cultural aspect, particularly maybe from your expertise in terms of the relationship of people to, like, physical relationships, mm-hmm. these engagement relationships that people started to develop with NASA centers, were there fundamental and permanent changes to people's expectations to a federal agency from the work that NASA did trying to bring people in overall, despite the failings that we just talked about? Like, how many people do this with the Department of Agriculture? Like, demand to see, like, headquarters of the Department of Agriculture and say, I want to have a full tour and see this myself.
I think that goes back to the act in which NASA was founded, having this third pillar of, needing to provide information to the public about what's going on. I think that is why NASA has particular visibility, and that also makes it vulnerable to particular scrutiny, right? So if you go to any shopping mall today, you'll find NASA t-shirts at H&M and Forever 21, all of these different places. You can buy NASA gear everywhere, but you can't do the same, as you mentioned, for FDA, or especially not for the IRS, right? And so I think that NASA's visibility is both a blessing and a curse. And its visibility was necessarily increased in the 60s because of this public criticism of the use of money on Project Apollo. But I will say that in, I think, 65, President Johnson issued a mandate to all federal agencies, which said, you need to increase your services to the public. So think about how to do that. And at the time, NASA reorganized some of its public affairs structure and continued to amplify its services. But that was something that was happening government-wide by the mid-1960s in terms of services to the public, not necessarily tours of centers.
Do you think the public, from the actions taken in the 60s, has a certain expectation now of access to NASA in particular, that we should, and this is deserved, and did that spread beyond Kennedy Space Center and Marshall, or the kind of the two first parts of that?
Absolutely. Every NASA center now, no matter how small, has a visitor center, whether or not they have full-time visitor programs or at least a community open house a few times a year. That is something that is a permanent change at NASA that started in this era, and I don't think we'll go back.
As we're kind of wrapping up here, I hope that we've demonstrated that Apollo wasn't just this monolithic, approved, everyone liked it, and by gosh, only if we could get back to that point in the history where the whole country was behind this, then we could go back to the moon again. Why do you think it's important for people to learn about this political resistance, the complications of this? What does that tell us? Like, why don't we just embrace this nice story that makes us feel good about the past?
It's incredibly important for the future of space exploration, because history repeats itself, and some of the arguments that were made against NASA at the time in the 60s are still leveraged against NASA today. So thinking about the ways in which the public engages with the space program and how that works within a democracy and how important that is incredibly vital to moving forward with a public space program.
Well, Dr. Emily Margolis, I want to thank you for joining us today. This was fascinating. I really hope to personally be a tourist at every single NASA center. That's my goal in life. I made it to a decent number of them. And Space Camp, I want to acknowledge, we are both adult
yes.
Space Camp graduates,
mm-hmm.
which I recommend that people do as well. And the Space Camp story, maybe we can have you on in the future to talk about why Space Camp is and where that came from, because that would be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Casey.
The Political History of Apollo was edited by Matt Kaplan and hosted by me, Casey Dreyer. It is a production of the Planetary Society, a nonprofit organization dedicated to space science and exploration. Anyone can be a member, so please consider joining the Planetary Society at planetary.org/membership. Your membership enables us to create projects like this podcast, as well as pursue our ongoing work in space advocacy, education, and technology. If you are already a member, thank you. Seriously, thank you. I want to also thank all of the guests on this show for their time and expertise, and to the band Wax Fang for the use of their song. If you enjoyed this show, please review it and share it with your friends. You might also like to check out our weekly podcast, Planetary Radio, and our monthly podcast, Planetary Radio Space Policy Edition. You can find both of them on all major podcast platforms and on planetary.org/radio. Stay tuned for our next episode. See you then.